Les colloques du Collège de France.
Donc j'ai le plaisir de vous accueillir pour cette dernière session où nous allons entendre Anne-Laura Stoller, qui est Willebrand Distinguished University Professor of Anthropology and Historical Studies à la New School for Social Research in New York, qui a fondé et dirige l'Institut, The Institute for Critical Social Inquiry, et qui est une des membres fondatrices du projet Political Concepts, a Critical Lexicon, qui a donné lieu à plusieurs publications. Elle est spécialiste d'histoire coloniale, d'histoire impériale, d'études coloniales et postcoloniales, de théorie féministe et études de genre. Elle a travaillé sur les politiques du savoir, les épistémologies raciales et l'ethnographie des archives. Parmi ses nombreux livres, en anglais, je voudrais citer Race and the Education of Desire, Carnal Knowledge and Imperial Power, 2002, et plus récemment, Interior Frontiers, Essays on the Entrails of Inequality, 2022. Et puis en français, puisque de nombreuses publications ont été traduites, un livre important, La chair de l'Empire, savoirs intimes et pouvoirs raciaux en régime colonial, paru à La Découverte en 2013. Toujours en 2013 avec Frédéric Cooper, Repenser le colonialisme. Plus récemment, Au cœur de l'archive coloniale, paru aux éditions de l'EHESS en 2019. Et qui va paraître très bientôt, en janvier prochain, aux éditions du CNRS, en français donc, un ouvrage, Dans les plis du pouvoir, à propos des sentiments. Linda, c'est à toi.
Merci bien, Magali. Before I even begin, I just want to thank so many people for staying for such a long day, your sustenance, your capacity to do so. It's never great to be the last speaker or the second to last, and certainly before Ashia Mbembe, who isn't here. But I hope that there's something you'll get from this. So it's an honor and a pleasure to be here. It really is, to celebrate in this company and in this special place, 100 years since Michel Foucault's birth, with immense thanks to Didier. Thank you, Didier, for the invitation to say something about Foucault's effect on the field of colonial and postcolonial studies, in whose province I've worked for some 45 years. Still, I find myself confronted, if not slightly cornered, before a set of long-recognized paradoxes that challenge that effect. Namely, well, so many of us know already, while Foucault's analytic and method of query shape the conceptual substance of the very inaugurating event of colonial studies 48 years ago. Now, that's not the beginning of studying colonialism. Please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm saying of a particular field, colonial studies, that is, with the 1978 publication of Edward Said's Orientalism, we know that the imperial terrain and colonial domains on which Said's assault was targeted were rarely ones Foucault addressed. Orientalism marked a paradigm shift in itself, broadly recognized as a brilliant frontal attack on European imperialism, while widely read as a political manifesto, absent the militancy of Fanon, that debunked the Euro-American Academy for supporting a distorted, bifurcated imaginary of a West and the rest, with lethal effect. As if Carl Schmitt's political vision of a world strictly divided between friend and enemy were set on that fictive longitude and in stone. Again, paradoxically, Said's text was threaded through Foucault's manner of exploding a discursive field, but most importantly, while making accessible how to do it. That is crucial in that spread, how to do it, placing Foucault and Said at the very apex of a transdisciplinary, largely Anglophone phenomena as a progressive, left academy wrestled with its changing notions of praxis and critique. What reemerged from the 1960s was a politics of knowledge full front, its actuality and its urgencies, a semi-legitimate academic domain. Again, paradoxically, was Foucault's formulation of knowledge regimes and their rules that served as Said's modus operandi, amplifying the force of what was already his radical refusal to stay within prescribed bounds. Putting Euro-American cultural imperialism, the title of a later book, on the line, Said set aside disciplinary protocols in locating across geography, literature, history, art, music, and philosophy, and more, the same recurrent tropes in word and image, degrading sometimes racist, sometimes eroticized categories of human worth, build to one side, obvious which side, exalting white and whitewashed ones on the other. Edward Said was a virtuoso of literary finesse, but his life vocation was weighted otherwise, as Fadi has said to us already, to pursue an unflagging condemnation of the Israeli-U.S. military and financial pact to destroy Palestine. Word has it, some people are saying this is a rumor, I'm not sure, have reported that both Said and Deleuze themselves, in separate conversations, said that Foucault was to remain removed from the conversations, detached with respect to the colonial status of Palestine. Many who later turned to Foucault ignored his silence, or actually didn't even know of it. It has hardly ever been mentioned. Students of colonialism took his lessons elsewhere, and as Fadi said, actually, I took it back again to Palestine, right? That relations of power are not hidden and in subtext, but there before us, nestled and snug in the most pernicious and innocuous, self-evident claims of common sense. Both the visible and the invisible scenes of power folded into the everyday. Little could better describe how the governing principles of colonialism's work, neither through coercion nor persuasion alone, though those are there for sure, but through discursive material exercises that wrap themselves around one's capacity to extricate from the violence of silent gestures and subsumptions, a favorite word of Marx, in which one is entangled. Still, as I wrote nearly 30 years ago, and Robert too noted at the time, colonialism was relegated to an outpost on Foucault's analytic map, not where his striking thinking about racism is, but was waiting for it to be said of the state and racism as a technology of rule, which we found in the 1976 lectures, were situated. Nor did his gaze turn to the colonial inflections where that taut knot of violence, fear, and anxiety was nourished by racial distinctions and categories that in turn were foundational features of the genocidal reflex of imperial formations. If in some quarters, and certainly from what we've seen all today, it's not these quarters, Foucault was thought to eschew the political. I mean, that's really interesting in itself. Given what we've heard today, how many people who probably don't know much about Foucault are absolutely convinced that he just stays away from the political. But the cumulative research, I'm not going to talk about that. The cumulative research that since has gained its gravitas and exerted its force to confront the colonial order of things suggests another accounting. For what is striking is how politically forthright that work is among those who have called on Foucault's, what I call his contagiously apt concepts and precision verbs, as they have patiently, tediously, impatiently garnered the minutiae of colonial dress as analytic practice and scoured the colonial archive used in the singular here because it is actually in the plural, the press, official documents, unsent letters, and confessional ones, for how intolerable brutalities are made common sense, rendered parenthetical lapses or swept aside. Projects trained on the meld of covert practice and overt policy have animated a sense of critique and commitment as an encounter with a question that had not been asked before, one blocked by the very constrained framework in which the political was sequestered and defined. So the political comes into question as well. If Foucault's watermark at times seems to show through everywhere, regardless of shadow or light, as frequently, its semi-transparency makes it hardly visible at all. It's a watermark etched in how we write colonial histories, how we read colonial archives, and the kinds of questions we ask of them. It may manifest in the quest for a close-up aperture, calibrated to a fine-grained reading of the banal, the mundane that we might not otherwise seek out or see. One might find it in the fragile points of dissonance on which one chooses to press, in a contradiction to a colonial common sense, where children of mixed marriages might and did refuse to abide by the white endowed script and choose not to go where privilege and comfort dwell, that is, with a white privileged father, rather than a Javanese mother, crushing the illusion of an irresistible white desire. Or it might come across as a jarring alert in the colonial archives, reference to another kind of colony, a penal colony turned colonial settlement, causing one to fumble, squint, look again. Was it a military encampment or a white colonial settlement? Was this a sort of Roland Barthes punctum, where the French army embossed water canteen out of place, produced a prick, a shock, destabilizing one's optic with another story to tell? Was carcerality and forced labor fodder for the engines of colonization, preparing Algeria for an influx of poor Frenchmen, pieds noirs, and Palestine to be trampled by Israelis' colonial settlements of demeaned Mizrahi Jewish North African families? Not only them, but them strategically placed at as outpost guards. To be clear, for this brief reflection, I've chosen to focus not on what Foucault did not do, written a book about that, rather what his work inspired us to reject, rethink, build upon, and do differently, if not better, in the surge of colonial studies that came after his untimely death in 1984. We can see these sweeps of new synergies in work that turn to the expanse and sometimes the limits of his landscapes, as many took on projects of looking at what occupied the thick corridors between metropole and colony and the webs of people, produce, and profit that redrew our global maps. And in the process, Foucault's limited cartographies mattered more, or maybe they just mattered less. Sometimes seeming to barely engage the domains he inspired, Foucault's watermark, barely visible, could morph into forms that did more than transgress. They mangled disciplinary assignments and gave new content to the form, not only of what we wrote, but how we did so. Colonized peoples across the globe were demanding that reckonings with the past were about actualities now. Foucault gave methodological weight to those political and material claims beyond returning confiscated figurines to Niger. That colonialisms could no longer be referred to ever again in the passé composé. And in those processes, the condition of possibility that keeps so much of the world returning recursively to the colonial metrics of power, spiral out beyond where a well-meaning liberal democratic public had seen them before. To biofuel, to unprecedented deforestations, to where is that peanut butter oil from? Which week is where it's from? I could talk about that for ages. Climatic effects in century-old plantation regions, and that leads to the rapid fire and slow violence, as Rob Nixon calls it, of Agent Orange, crystallize in distorted young Vietnamese bodies today, and those of US veterans, the latter, the only ones considered collateral damage to receive compensation. Foucault rightly held that vigilance is what, and it's a word he used quite often, is what critique must maintain. Work that is self-reflectively insolent, seared with accountability, singed by responsibility to the social inequalities of the present. Colonial studies took that injunction as an ethical and political commitment, increasingly over the decades, to track the durabilities of colonial duress. For some, the vast environmental destruction, the massacres actually in colonial archives, neither lost nor secreted, but those people refused to comment upon or see. As with the archives of fascism and authoritarianisms, colonial bureaucracies were proud of their atrocities and kept good, righteous, detailed accounts. Sorry, I'm from the plane. Looking to just four domains in which engagements with both the content and form of Foucault's work is still in this sort of act of making and formulation, I see his capacity to make concept work at once a political and analytic pursuit, where the sense and sound of languages inheres in the project, pressing for an evocative vocabulary, sometimes joined to Foucault's, sometimes of its own. I think to biopower and its morph into biosecurity, and then back to the biopolitics of settler colonialism, the of producing at once a rift in the concept and an entirely new trajectory of bodily protection and harm. I think of the ways in which a colonial archive and colonial archives in their materiality have come to be seen as accretions of evidence, producing the categories they only purport to describe as technologies of rule and violence. One might look to the histories of colonial medicine being overhauled, pulled increasingly to what new imperatives were satisfied and the need to strip, to touch, to scrutinize, and to rehearse again what young white medics wanted to ensure they could see. Real traction, though, came as colonial studies itself, mutated and molted with a surge of work articulating with 9/11. And the mandate to protect from and locate the enemy within, to engage the kinds of subjects and dispositions the colonial condition produced, and the terrifyingly insecure-making security regimes, obviously, that flourished. Challenges came in reckoning with the contradictions of partaking in the imperial gaze and living under it at the same time. The 1976 Collège de France lecture, Society Must Be Defended, did and do something nodal on a different scale, not only articulating the making of who is subject to life or premature death, as Ruth Gilmore defined racism, but naming a logic and a rationale and the biopolitical architecture of imperial formations, the murderous rationales of self defense, elevated to the ultimate right to kill. Security regimes operating on person and polity with ever more insecurities that need to be defended against than we have. Il faut défendre la société. Upholding the tasks of preparedness and the conditions in which one is never prepared enough with ever more creative reinvention. Foucault's gift I see as part temptation and challenge to pursue a multiplex conceptual methodology. That's a term that I use a lot with my students, for them never to see as methodologies. You can take a course in methodology and, you know, it's sitting there on its own. A multiplex conceptual methodology that is a political force of its own, accruing and underscoring magnitudes of self-selective harm and targeted damage. Damage is material, but also in how knowledge is disqualified, a hugely important term when we're thinking about colonialism, and refused a qualified endowment. A quixotic turn of what counts as knowledge has deep political consequences, reminding that things could always be otherwise. For critical genealogy, as Bernard Harcourt invokes the term, can find disqualified ways of knowing reasserted, the first lecture of 1976. Resurrected, that's Foucault's verb in 1976. Emergent with political potentiality and potency again. Genealogies have no straight lines. They have detours, failures, defeats that deserve narrations. Arrested histories, I love this term, as one of my former graduate students, Carol McGranahan, described those Nepalese ones overwritten by Indian political mythologies. Genealogies promise political accountability and harbor preserved possibilities. That beautiful term Lawrence Hirschfeld described as woven into the everyday masterpieces of Kuna clothing and Samblas art for a future moment. I see critical genealogy approaching history as a living organism, as an organic substance deep in the soil, in the peat turned to ash, as political practice. Joining with the concept of Etienne Balibar has gifted us politicality, the practices and sites that harbor other choices of a way of life that refuse to be governed by them and in this way. Whether looking to New Caledonia or Canadian tribal refuses to accept the terms of US citizenship requirements and be hailed as an American when they cross the border, the famed Caribbean poet, Nobel laureate Derek Walcott, captured the harm festering in detritus left behind. He named colonialism an ulcerous crime, as he called it, the rot that remains when the men are gone. Anti-colonialisms today are tasking themselves with severing those veins, still pulsing with indignations and pollutants. Power concentrates in phantom colonial states, but more so in dispersed forms that reach into the intimate social ecologies of the everyday. Childcare, the sick bedroom, the family, and the home. Not least, it may take the form of ethical disquiet, as Foucault defined critique as the ethics of discomfort. Ethical disquiet with respect to the we used to write in search for a non-masterly inclusive mode. The unease remains, as Foucault reminded, the we is precarious. I'm using it quite a bit. And can't be constituted before the question is posed. I use it here in a limited sense. For those whose work I know with some sense of why and how they've pursued the risky questions they have sought to ask. For some, it is as if our eyes were outfitted with a different lens, the texturing grain of colonialism's violating force coming into ever stronger relief, and we becoming ever more adept at recognizing the blur of illegible proclamations that were in fact political strategy, peering through those crossed out phrases so easily seen through in documents, so blinding in official ease, they would seem to have no political bearing at all. These were moments we've taken to pause, to resist the rush, breaches of the self-evident, as Foucault defined an event, can be seemingly unremarkable queries that should not be asked nor addressed. In treating archive work as a political project, we might do well to follow Adiela Zule's lead to proclaim ourselves the colonial archive's new guardians and the true archons. Here, archival redactions command attention. Unintelligibilities read less as a bureaucratic oversight than a piece of concerted politics. As we learn, changes in nomenclature and categories for those who were seen to be mixed or not had real consequences, demanding intense reading in the archive's folds as composite elements in a logic of rule. They no longer look the same after reading Foucault. Foucault cannot be credited with fashioning that awareness alone, obviously. Many of us have been learning how to read with Barthes, with Ducerteau, George Steiner, Arlette Fage, who shared the shock of the nuance of the quotidien with Foucault. Many of us were long avid readers of Marx, Rosa Luxemburg, Frantz Fanon, E.P. Thompson, Stuart Hall, and Samir Amin. Still, one could argue that Foucault's style of confrontation with what passed for colonial common sense and the literary fictions that surrounded them was at that time in the 1990s and early years of the century, not only under the skin of those daring to question what they knew about the colonial order of things, but enabling harder questions. How they knew it, and in turn, how those who commanded and inhabited colonial battalions and bureaucracy thought they knew what they did, and what those in the service of empire did when what they claimed to know, they did not. The accounts they conjured in ignorance, sometimes compelled to make up plausible stories of blame, in the speed required for bureaucratic reporting, are palimpsests of their own, dossiers layered with scrabblings over what could bear the burden of proof. And whether the answer confirmed and went along with the current regime of truth. Who committed a recent murder? Or whether a revolt was in the making and by whom? And which rumors could and should relay a call to arms? What could bear the burden of proof for a claimed truth was a political diagnostic of how effectively racial regimes of truth were operating and how viciously they were policed. James Baldwin called this racialized version of truth the evidence of things not seen, that indeed were in clear view and bright light. I've referred to this capacity to look away after having had to have looked, as Jean-Paul Sartre put it, a politics of disregard, a fundamental feature honed in the multiple scenes over time and space in imperial formations. For if the archive was, as Foucault put it, the law of what could be said, we also knew it really wasn't at all, that it was full of this marginalia, brash, or in sotto voce, that went far beyond what could and should be said. Colonial archives produced, as I've said, the racial categories they only purported to describe, but it was also there that the ubiquity of a unified colonial hegemony, which was the imaginary narrative of the colonial, could show its wear and be torn to shreds. How am I doing on time?
I would say 5 minutes.
Subjectivities and subjugations were tethered more loosely to colonialism's regime of truth than colonialisms tell about themselves. Who is really European? By what criteria? The lilt of one's Dutch, one's dress, residence, or a stipulated as stipulated in a proof that could be undone in an instant or hidden for years, the ultimate legal task resting wholly on the distribution of sentiment. As in the Dutch East Indies, 1898 legal access to European equivalents, it depended on where one felt they no longer had affinity or felt to be at home. Gevoel thuis, to feel at home. As Foucault insisted, every sentiment has a history, leaving it for us to do that tracing. What became increasingly visible were the exclusions and rote narratives built into the colonial politics of epistemology. With what felt like Foucault's leverage, and it's always that leverage behind us, we were after those words and things and materialities that produced who could not be where, when, even without a word. Colonial curfews, pass cards, signs in 1930s Java, no dogs or natives in the swimming pool. Our archival excavations were political projects. Foucault turned the self-evident on its head, posing it as a distracting, as a ruse, whose protected status as shared truth in colonial context was more fragile than professed. As George Orwell confided to his readers in Shooting an Elephant, he was subservient to what he was supposed to do as a white colonial and didn't want to do as his own person or other imagined self. Not only was he humiliated by the prospect of not shooting the elephant and the laughter that would follow, worse still, he knew he wasn't exempt. As he put it, I quote, "The white colonial mask, the white colonial wears a mask, and his face grows to fit it," unquote. Orwell's mask seems to have remained abrasive against his skin. The imperial politics of sympathy was never innocent either, as the withering work of Amat Rai showed years ago, thinking again with Foucault to expose colonial benevolence's satisfying allure for bourgeois selves in the making. Those concerned with the coagulations of imperial power looked to Foucault adjacent, thinking themselves to be beyond him, and then finding him still by their side. Some of these rethinkings stand out, turning metropolitan colony inside out, seeing colonial contexts as quintessential locations where biopolitics literally manage the racial geography of disease and who had to be protected, who was to be cordoned off in the contaminated spaces of its breeding. Frederick Groh elevated the principle of security and insecurity to its specific historical conditions that legitimated state management. But that was for liberalism, not empire. Others turned to how biosecurity came to exceed biopolitics in its capacity to map where public services for sewage and water were managed or not in the post-colony, where garbage was left exposed. Stephen Collier, and I'm naming names on purpose, not as 1950s, MacArthurism, but because I think it's important to know the people who are doing some of this work. Stephen Collier's work on biopolitics, security, and preparedness was to nourish how we have come to understand the megaforce of imperial formations, despite no reference to them, as did the work of Martin Thomas on the imperial technologies of intelligence and security, honed in the colonizing aggressions in the Middle East. Infrastructure has emerged in this work as Antina Schitzner as essentials to racialize urban biopolitical regimes today, and DGA's own call to return to life as such, a feature of biopolitics that perhaps await those not smothered by what liberalism is said to do, but by the structures of inequality that have made a precariat more vocal and united than it has ever been before. The resources are there in critical genealogies, imperial histories of the present. Almost done. Foucault informs some of the most daring research projects of another genre in what Guillaume called Foucault's concern with, I quote, the medicine of the mind. Nancy Hunt leans in on Foucault for her decades of subtle work on bodies and minds warped and twisted through colonial logics of care. Foucault is a guide, but only so far. She looks to the liminal spaces of measured reason and dissent that colonialism in Africa produced over and again with madness, often less discernible than, as she puts it, I quote, depression as a plentiful historical sea. Laure Manicom's dizzying account of confinement and genealogy in the illegal institutions known as mental hostels in South India, persons shackled in care at once forbidden by the state, that is shackling, and sanctioned and supported by their families. Nancy Hunt, Guillaume Lachanel, Megan Vaughan, Laure Manicom spiral us out from the confines of Foucault's gaze while sharing in and beholding to his unique vision, staying close, as Hunt put it, to his, quote, longing to hear the speech and sounds of the mad. We see it in the ways that colonial governing practices line the everyday, brought denuded fields and forests into stark view, as colonial biopolitics perversely rehearsed who was to survive, be abandoned, or profit from the miles and years of multinational plantation cultivation that left scarred inhabitable space for meager foraging. I was gonna give you more. Can I do 2 more minutes? Oh. Okay, one minute. What remains striking are the sources from which those of us caught in the colonial web of violence have learned, from those who are not working on colonialism at all, from François Ewald, Pierre Marchery, Judith Revel, Frédéric Gros, Arlette Farge, Lou Pelterini, Arnold Davison, Herbert Dreyfus, Colin Guy. There's so many Daniel Lorenzini, and so many more, and too many men. And then, of course, from those luminous ones who have spoken here today. The lines of communication exchange were and are alive, almost rhizomic, right, and vividly open. And in all of this, one of the overarching challenges is to think critical genealogy, and genealogy is critical, as Martin has shown us, as promise, praxis, and politics, bringing disqualified knowledges and dissent central to the narratives of colonialism's usurpations, struggles over land, resources, minerals, and labor, deciding the terms of engagement. It is these confrontations, these resilient practices, re-endowed as the raw extended relations of force, that we're compelled to reckon with now as our histories of the present. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.